Hi, this is your host, Gareth Rice, and you're listening to Canadiana Suite on UMFM 101.5 radio station. This is a radio program primarily dedicated to highlighting the works of the many talented Canadian jazz artists on the scene today. We'll be joined by Mike Rudd, a guitarist and educator currently teaching at Selkirk College in British Columbia. He won a Juno in 2014 for his album Notes on Montreal, and has collaborated with notable musicians such as Peter Bernstein, Joey DeFrancesco, Herb Ellis, and he also studied with Jim Hall. Before the interview, I'd just like to take the time to commemorate National Dave Brubeck Day. What's that? You've never heard of it? You think I'm confusing it with something else that's supposed to happen today? What the f*** is Star Wars? You know, National Dave Brubeck Day, it's like the 4th day of May, and like May is the 5th month of the year. You put that together and it's like 5-4. Dave Brubeck, take 5, 5-4, you know. Now, since you know what it is, what better way to celebrate it than with a great 5-4 Peter Bernstein tune called Jive Coffee, off his 1995 album Signs of Life, also featuring Brad Meldow, Christian McBride, and Greg Hutchinson. Joining us is Mike Rudd, a guitarist and educator based in Selkirk, Manitoba. He's played with notable musicians such as Peter Bernstein, Herb Ellis, Joey DeFrancesco, and Juana Juno for his 2014 album, Notes on Montreal, which took inspiration from the titular city and its literature. How are you doing, Mike?
I'm doing great, thanks.
Cool.
I should mention, I'm actually in Nelson, British Columbia, not Selkirk, Manitoba. I'm in Selkirk College.
There you go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's because these mountains right around here are called the Selkirk Mountains.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. I guess the first question is, what got you into jazz?
A couple of things. Being a guitar player, that's sort of an attraction to popular music that they were talking about the late 1970s, early 1980s. And so I had a really good high school music program where, there was a concert band and sort of classical music stuff, but also there were jazz big bands. And that was probably the beginning of that. And then I had this teacher, this really great player, a guy named Brian Hughes, who lives in Los Angeles, I think now. And he played kind of in a Pat Metheny-ish, Grant Green-ish kind of style. And that really spoke to me, So yeah, it was that basically. And then just a whole bunch of going to school and getting gigs and practicing.
Yeah, the natural trajectory from what I've seen. Yeah. And a lot of my friends too. Yeah. But speaking of guitar, who would you say are your primary influences?
Let's see. For jazz guitar. Oh yeah. There's kind of a core there of George Benson, Grant Green, Wes Montgomery would be the kind of core three, the sort of blues based bebop guys. I love Pat Martino too, and then there's the further you get into it, then you get all these people. I mean, I was lucky to be able to study a little bit with Jim Hall back in the mid 90s in New York, and then there's some Canadian guitar players that I just love. I'm crazy about Sonny Greenwich. You ever listen to his music? It's just beautiful, man. So yeah, those would be the main ones. And then, of course, that's just the guitar players. In this music, you wind up, the real canon of it was not created by the guitar players, it was created by the horn players and the piano players and the vocalists. And so you wind up listening to a hell of a lot of that and absorbing it. And, oh man, it's just been so fulfilling, so interesting.
Yeah, I think there's so many great albums and like just so many like great players out there. It's
that's right. And you meet players you've never known before, and you instantly have a sort of shared canon of things that you've, like my roommate is this guy, you should interview this dude too. In fact, he's up for a Juno Award this year. His name's David Rustivo.
Yeah, yeah.
Out of Toronto originally. He's originally, I think, from Vermont or something, but he was in Toronto for years and years and years, played in the Boss Brass. And I moved here and became his roommate about just under 3 years ago. And so we don't have a shared history. We only met a few times before that. We made one record together, but we didn't know each other super well. But there'll be times when I'll be, in the house doing something and I'll go like, and then I'll hear him from the other side of the house go, and we'll come into the same room and go, it's like, there's a way in which we've known each other for decades because of all that connected tissue, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's partially due to that music. It's also just music in general. We'll do that same thing with, because we're on the same age, we'll do the same thing with, tunes from the 80s and 90s and stuff.
Yeah, I do that with my friends all the time. Just like, quote a blues head and it's like,
it's impossible not to, yeah.
Yeah, it's catchy. Yeah. You mentioned that you studied with Jim Hall in New York. So I'm curious to know, like, what kind of skills did you learn, which you continue to use as a guitarist?
Well, what I loved There was a hell of a lot. What I loved about Jim, there was a few really important things about him for me. One is that he seemed to focus not so much on the specific details of like what are the exact technical scales and pieces of vocabulary and whatever you're going to use. Is more they were broader things like how do you pace like music across an evening, or how do you pull an audience in with the importance of like melody and tone. And I found that really neat because you could take those lessons and go off and play in completely different directions with them, and your overarching commitment would be to the loftier ideas about the art, rather than, it must be tempting for teachers to turn the students into clones of themselves because you share the specifics that have worked for you and you don't want to misguide the students, right? But he found a way to get to the broader things that were like, well, you could wind up playing very differently from me, and we would still share these sort of things that we think are important about engaging and speaking to a group of people in the room and keeping them in your thrall, that was a big thing. Melody, he was hugely picky about whether you were really letting somebody at the back of the room know how you think that what that melody means, at least right then, and not hiding it or hedging it or he was wonderful for that. And then his main things, apart from that, were things about developing a small idea into a larger one. And it's a funny thing, because of how jazz music fits together. There's that, which sounds a lot like the type of thing you have, like, sort of a main plan, an overarching plan for your grand artistic statement. And then at the very same time, you're having a conversation with people who are right there, and they might take it to a different place. In fact, if you chose the right people, they usually will. So it's this funny synthesis of flexibility and thinking about the larger shape of things at the same time, and yet being right there in that specific moment. He was incredible for that. I went and saw him play a bunch of times, and he was ready to respond, very flexibly to what was happening in that moment. And it was beautiful to see. I think there was times when, yeah, he's got impressive things under his fingers he could just resort to if he wanted to just sort of kind of wow the audience or something. But it's like, no, listen to what's happening on the ride cymbal there. That's interesting. I want to talk to who's here with me on the bandstand, right? It was wonderful to see. Very collaborative.
Yeah, definitely. Like all you said, like I've heard those same sentiments echoed like constantly throughout like my teachers and like my friends and stuff. And
It's a beautiful thing.
yeah. And it's
So
such an
you're at U of M, are you?
fourth year.
Oh, I'd love to come. I'd got to come there and visit and meet the people and stuff, because Winnipeg is this. I used to live right over by there when I was a kid for 1 year. I lived in Fort Richmond. And like Winnipeg, because I'm originally more or less from Edmonton, and then I lived over in Montreal for many years. I lived in Vancouver and Victoria and Ottawa for a while. Winnipeg was always just far enough away. Of course, the internet has completely changed this, but that it was, you would hear about some of the Winnipeg players, but it's a 17-hour drive from Edmonton, so you're not going to go there and just do a couple of gigs with them and drive back, right? And so there's always been a slight element of mystery about Winnipeg to me. And the one time I did manage to get there and play, I was blown away. I went and played with the Winnipeg Jazz Orchestra for a thing, and Jesus, there's so many beautiful musicians in that city. It's marvelous.
Definitely, yeah, there's like so much great musicians there, and like two of them actually got nominated for a Juno as well, Will Bonis and John Gordon.
And these are not guys I know. You know what I mean? Like I grew up in the sort of Canadian family of that, where there was like, but at that point there was like half as many schools teaching the stuff, and you know, the just the sheer number of people that play at a really high level now has mushroomed to where, like, okay, time to find out who everybody is, man.
Yeah, puzzle pieces. It's a it's a large tapestry. Tapestry. Tomato.
Tomato. Tomato. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess speaking of Montreal, what inspired the creation of Notes of Montreal? Because I saw that it was like inspired by the literature, and like Sienna Dolan was singing on it too.
Yeah. Oh, she hit that one out of the park for me, man. That was, I had done like a project with her, literally a school project when I was doing a master's degree at McGill, and she was in her bachelor's degree. And I knew that I liked her singing, so I got her to sing, and it was string quartet and her singing and me playing. And I kind of wrote like a singer-songwriter style tune, and then wrote interesting stuff for the strings and put a guitar solo in there for myself. And it came out, I was just really haunted by it. And I did another thing right after that of a 13-piece string orchestra, two tunes, because at school you sometimes can get these opportunities for something that in real life, that thing would cost you 10 grand to get that recording made. Right. But you get it made for like bagels and grapes and Goodwill. And it gives you ideas about going forward. Like, whoa, what? So for like a decade after that, I had these three recordings we had made that I was really kind of stuck on them. I knew I wanted to do something in that direction as like an album length project. And one day in Montreal, after this is like the third time I had lived in Montreal. So I could never leave that place for good, right? Like I love it so much. So I was walking down the street and they were filming a movie. They were filming Barney's Version, which was a Mordecai Richler novel. And it was on my block. They were filming a scene from it. And I realized, like, that's what gets me really excited, is when somebody sets a story in a place that I've actually lived, you know, in my hometown. That like kind of lights me up. I know, okay, that I could be, because if you're going to do like a thing where you write all the music and you write lyrics, it's going to be like a marriage. You're going to have to survive getting disillusioned and bored with this thing and all those things. You're going to have to go through. It's a long-term relationship. And I was like, that I could stretch that into an album length premise, because there's enough to work with there and I can get excited enough about it. And so I started, and it from beginning to the end of release was a little over 3 years, maybe about 4 years, to get it all written and rewritten and rewritten and do all the string arranging. I went back and had lessons with my old arranging teacher and all that stuff. And then started working with Sienna on, you know, the keys and the fine details. And this producer we had who works in Edmonton now at McEwen, he's originally an Ottawa guy. We met in Montreal, but he lives in Edmonton now. His name's Paul Johnston. And he figured out how you produce a 9-piece band with a string quartet vocal album on a budget, and he figured it out really well. I was really lucky. That guy's a wizard. I was really lucky that he got it, because he did everything. He solved all these technical problems, and he did that other producer hat really well, where you have to know the psychology of the people you're recording, whether they've got better takes in them that they don't realize yet, or whether they're about to get so mad that they're gonna quit and you'll lose a half a day, or you know, all those kind of things. And he brought it all, and then he put a beautiful spit shine on the whole thing using every trick in the book. And yeah, man, that's the most solid I've ever felt about any musical projects, because of the sheer number of hours of work that went into it. I know for a fact that I can't do any better than that, which is a wonderful position. You do so many projects, even ones you care about a lot, where, oh, if only we'd had time to work on this and that, you know, if only we'd had time to fix this or that, not that one, like somebody else could have done a better job of it, but I had every chance to do, you know, I had no excuses. Anything that's on there is as good as I can produce. So that's a nice feeling to have at least gone and checked that out. I have no misgivings about whether I could have done better. You know what I mean? Like, people could do better. Lots of them could do better, but that's the best I could do. So that's very, personally, that's quite fulfilling.
Yeah, it must be a great feeling because, like, there's always a musician's dilemma of like, oh, I need to tweak this or tweak that. So just knowing when to walk away and say like, yeah, this is cool. This is, I'm
Well,
satisfied
you
with this.
mentioned Jim Hall earlier. One of the big things that was great for me about meeting him was he showed a way of playing the instrument that didn't mean you had to be constantly trying to be, have blazing technique. It was a way of playing the instrument that could allow you to age somewhat gracefully. And that helped solve an emotional problem I had around that issue because I gave myself bad tendonitis right after my bachelor's degree. Because you spend all these years being told what to play and how to practice and how to think about it, and they give you no time to actually absorb it. They just spend the whole time loading you up, which is frustrating and great. And it meant when I got out of school, I started practicing 8 hours a day in addition to teaching and gigging and whatever. And my hands went kerblooey on me, and I had tendonitis. And that was right before I met Jim and started working with Jim. And so I was coping with this, like, I can't simply put in these mammoth practice days. I have to have other ways of developing, of saying what. And so by the time I rolled around to making notes on Montreal, I had kind of could walk away because my hands were giving me no choice about it. It's like, this is my little art and craft project that I can put together with pipe cleaners and glitter glue, and that's my little thing. And I know for a fact that I can't do any better, or I can't put more hours into that, or I'm going to run the risk of messing up my hands to the point where maybe I'd never be able to play again. So that somewhat forced a solution onto the around anything to do with the guitar. I've always got a bit of a complex where, well, it can't really be purely chops based. Everything that's in my fingers that's involves a lot of repetition and any degree of finger athleticism, that all was there by the time I was about 30 years old, or even earlier, because, and I can tweak it. And what I like the most is I can rearrange it into different orders, and I can change the context, and I can put words over it, or use different textures, or play with different people. And that all makes it infinitely malleable, even though it, in a way, it expanded my view to a thing where instead of having it be how much can I leverage this one dimension of it so I can win the arms race with the other guitar players, right? And more to like, oh, this is an open-ended thing, it could go in a zillion different directions, and that's a much gentler way of being able to think about projects like that, so that you're not just seeing yourself as a someone who has to produce this one line that's on a linear scale. And it's, but that's also a change that comes between your early 20s as an obsessed young man and your 40s, when by the time your kids have come along and you've sort of seen that the best laid plans of mice and men, oh, okay, it's wider than that. Just got to be a little patient.
Yeah, you got to pace yourself. There's
Yeah,
more than.
lots of things that'll happen. Things that you think are the worst thing that are happening to you. Sometimes they have, yeah, they're the worst thing, but also they have like a little gift in them someplace, maybe,
Yeah. Oh, speaking of the like open-ended like guitar focus you were talking about, how did that come into focus when you were playing with Peter Bernstein on your album Salome's Dance? Because you kind of did like a two guitar thing.
Yeah. Well, that, more than anything else, after I made that Montreal record, and then I made another record where I just played by myself and sang and tried to, it's called Miniatures. And I tried to like come up with really interesting solutions to the problem of how do you engage an audience for 45 minutes without a band, but without just singing and strumming, although that's a beautiful thing. But I wanted to, and use some of the edumacation that I had gotten, right? So it meant that I was playing a hell of a lot of guitar, and I was And then I might, you know, this is after I met Peter in the early 90s in Montreal because he was visiting. And then I went to New York and didn't get to know him terribly well there, but he was very friendly and encouraging. And we hung out a little tiny bit. And so then many years later, when I've gone and made these other records and lots of things happen in your life, I had kids and gotten divorced. And now I'm sitting there thinking, there's just so many little areas of my earlier development where I got really lucky with a thing. I should continue to kind of mine that. And I'm like, oh yeah, that's right. I know Peter Bernstein. And he, you know, because of who he is, he's gone on to really define how people play kind of the contemporary idea of straight ahead jazz guitar, pre-fusion jazz guitar. Lucky me, I met him back then. So it was mostly like, you know, I bet I could get him to come up here and play a gig. And I asked him, and he very graciously did. And that went really nicely. And then he came up another couple of times, and we made that record. But it was mostly that I wanted to document that happy accident that I just by virtue of having been in Montreal in 1992 when we were both, you know, in our early 20s. I had met this guy, and he was a sweet enough person, and that he was willing to come up and play with, you know, somebody he knew a little, but not a lot, you know. Oh, well, make a record for heaven's sake, you know, strike while the iron's hot. And so I just finished touring, like a Western Canadian tour of that solo album, because that's an easy tour to sell granting agencies on, because you're just you, right? It's a nice cheap tour. And it's nice cheap programming for the festivals too, but it's wicked good for your guitar playing because you're holding the groove for 45 minutes by yourself. And that's really good. Like that's medicine, you know? So I did like a week and a half of that or 2 weeks of that. And then I flew from the last event was a two shows in one night in Edmonton that ended very late. And I flew from that to Ottawa, where the next afternoon I was doing this clinic with Peter, who I hadn't seen in like 25 years. And I was exhausted. I had about 3 hours of sleep, and I walked in, and my friend Peter Hum, who's a music critic in Ottawa, and a great piano player and songwriter too, he was like, oh man, Mike's playing with Bernstein. I should record this. So he brought his video camera with it, and I didn't realize he was going to do that, or he might have told me, but I was too busy to notice. And we started playing, and because of the 2 weeks of playing solo, I was in the best shape I ever get into on the guitar. And then we had a beautiful bass player, this guy named Alec Walkington, who's kind of fixture of the Montreal scene. And there it was, me and Peter and Alec, and we just played a bunch of tunes, and Peter Hum that recorded them. And yeah, I'm really happy those exist. Those videos are a little bit like the album in that they kind of document this thing that I was really lucky to have been in the right place at the right time. And that I, every time you might be in the right place at the right time, for God's sake, record it. You know, first of all, you get used to the fact that you're recording, and you stop being, you know, kind of thrown by, oh no, how's it gonna go? Who gives a shit? I mess things up all the time. It's just be another tape of me messing something up. Who cares? It's better that I should have the three things that worked out on some piece of tape someplace, you know? And it was great. And then we did the record, and I wrote a bunch of tunes for those, but I just wrote contrafacts, you know, largely they're either jazz standards with a different melody written for them, or they're so close to the way your average jazz standard works that Peter could accidentally play that, you know, a perfect solo on that without even, you know, you can't throw it. You're gonna get beautiful, beautiful. And the same goes for the other two guys on. That's that same bass player, Alec Walkington, and Dave Lang on drums, who they call Scooter. He was originally from Ottawa. He lived in Montreal for many, many years. That's where we made that record. But then right after that, he moved to Edmonton too. He started teaching drums at Grant McEwen University there.
Nice.
Very long-winded answer. Sorry to be so yappy.
That's fine. Yeah, I'm a really big fan of that album because I really liked Shuffle Pants. That was like kind of like a cool blues thing, and Leonard Cohen
Thank
that
you.
originally wrote. Yeah, it was pretty
Well,
sick.
now, so Shuffle Pants is my romance.
Oh, that's what it was.
So sewing on it, I mean, it's like an even and it's even a little simpler than like the changes of the head are actually slightly bluesed up, like the tonic chords are dominant, and
Yeah.
but it's basically My Romance, and then you soloing, you just play on My Romance more or less. I mean, I think either My Romance or some slightly more simple version even than that to go with the vibe, and then Leonard Cohen is one of those few times when I've actually gone, what if I wrote a tune the way composition teachers have told me? And I went to the idea of like, you ever heard that thing? What instrument do you play?
Piano.
Piano. So, that constant fifths thing, where you just start on a C and you just go a fifth up, a fifth up, a fifth up, and you can get through the whole chromatic scale. Now, a friend of mine had shown me that on guitar in New York in the 90s, and I was like, well, that's pretty cool. And in the back of my mind, I'm like, I'll never use that. Who uses that? And so then when I go to, write like a composition, I'm like, well, one of the hard things when you go to write a thing is not writing the same old crap you always write, not writing your hand habits. So that's, I think, is why composition teachers do so much of giving you exercises that are restrictions, like try writing without this or try writing without that. So I went to that thing. And I thought, how close could I come to building the melody of this thing as almost nothing but perfect fifths ascending or perfect fourth descending, which is the inversion of that, right? And then how much can I reflect that in the chord progression structure? Can I even have that? And so of course, if you stick just locked into one premise like that, it burns itself out really quickly. So you have to, okay, I'm gonna loosen the rules a little bit. I can repeat a thing I just did and change the harmony under it. And as long as I then continue on to the, I can put a little something in for these four bars that is not derived from that premise. If I feel like aesthetically I've earned it at that point, it feels like it answers the previous thing nicely. And finally, who can play on such a tune with standard, Grant Green style vocabulary? Nobody can. So oh, make it a ballad. That way it's going by slow enough that you can not worry about, scrambling after the changes. You can just kind of swim in this lake of. And that thing on that record, that was the one take we ever did of it. I never played it a second time until about 2 weeks ago with Bill Kuhn at CAP University in Vancouver in front of the students. I think that was the second time it ever got played in front of, well, at all. Because we played it one time into the microphones at the studio in Vancouver, and like not only do you know what the thing that blows my mind on that record is Peter's comping. It's a miracle of support and interest and texture, and he does it live. Like, you ever see that guy play live? I'm sure you have. I'm sure he's coming, right? And it's every great player has a whole bunch of just their own stuff that they evolved, and it's related to everybody else's stuff, but it's also very much their own, Like Eddie Bickert, my favorite ballad and chord player, far and away. I mean, maybe in a, but then the ways that Jim Hall is great at that stuff are different. It's, there might be a few little points of connection, but it's astonishingly shot through with their own personalities, And then Peter's got and for my money, kind of equal to either of those guys, like a palette of his own really finely wrought little gossamer solutions for those moments where it's like, how did you do that? How did you make my solo sound better? Play something that's more interesting than the solo. Without getting in my way, how did he mix support and stealthily being the star of the thing, in a way that you just wish you just want to hear him do it again and again and again. Like it doesn't, never gets in the way of the solo, but it's way more interesting than the solo. He does that across the whole record. And then I noticed that the other two guys, that Al and Dave Lang, that drummer, they've been playing together in Montreal since they were kids, and they've been playing with whoever the visiting luminaries were coming through Montreal. Every time Ed Bicker would come to Montreal, he'd be like, "Well, okay, if we can get that drummer again, can we get Dave Lang again?" And when Barry Harris came through, Barry played with Dave, that drummer, like when I was back there, when he came and visited McGill and gave us like a solid week of clinics. It was insane. And then many years later, I was living in Vancouver, in Ottawa, and Barry was coming to Ottawa. My friend Jerry Shatford brought Barry in to play at the Cafe Paradiso there, and he got Kieran Overs on bass from Toronto, and he got and Barry was like, "Yeah, I'll come out to Ottawa, but we have to, only if we can get that drummer, right?" And okay, no problem. And I it was $60 a plate to go and eat, overpriced but still very good food, but listen to Barry for three sets. And for all he is as a teacher, which is incredible, his touch on the piano, like it's pure confection. There was never any time I ever heard him play live that I didn't want it to be twice as long. Like I could just eat that all day long, just sitting there listening to the way he touches the thing and all the wit and lightness, and it's so, it's such nourishing art, the way that guy touched a piano. Wow. So, but and that was sort of nice. I was real proud of Dave that, that guy, when he comes around, it's Dave he wants to make those textures with, and it made me real happy to put Dave and Alec together on a record with Peter. And I think it worked. We got some real nice little, these cavernous, there's a lot of ballads on the album, and there's these cavernous textural spaces where they really make the notes kind of hang in midair, and they frame everything so nicely. So it's really, that's why I made that record, is mostly I just wanted to, hey, this is, I want 10 years from now, I want to remember I took that chance to play some music with the great Peter Bernstein. And then we made the record, and I'm like, good. I'm glad it's there. I don't even really feel the need to tour it a whole lot. He's a busy guy. And but thank God we made it when we did. Because the day after he split Montreal from that recording, the job posting for the place I'm working now went up. And I interviewed and got the gig, and was gone like 4 months later. So you hit strike while the iron's hot. I knew, hey, whatever's going to happen, I probably won't. How do you know you're going to have chances to play and record and perform in public and whatever? For it? Do all the ones you can if it's important to you, because you never know. And then when COVID came, I felt kind of good about that decision. Like, okay, thank God, while there was chances to play and audiences to play for, I took that chance, because they don't feel like, I don't sort of repine this. Oh, if only I had. No, I ran with it. I played it. My policy was every time I could not lose more than $25 by playing, go and play, And sometimes it was way better than that. Sometimes people, pay you way more than that. But it was like the playing, and it's particularly where people are listening, So such a joyous thing to be able to do in your life. So do it, do it, do it, do it, do it.
Definitely, it's such a privilege.
Definitely.
Yeah.
I like this. Now you got me curious. I want to come and hear you play.
Thanks. Yeah, I think I've gotten pretty good over the few years, and
Sweet. You having a good time out there?
Well, I guess like COVID is like still around, so like the gigs aren't as big as they aren't. But like my degree is like in person now, so it should be fun, and like my recital should be on track for being in person. That should be
Nice.
nice. Yeah.
We've been having our student showcases here at Selkirk College, and It's not exactly a jazz school. Like it's like a very jazz friendly pop music school, and it's very small. At the end of the semester, we have these student showcases, but because it's so pop oriented, they're like a show you would pay cover for or whatever, and the students go nuts turning them into shows. And I mean, they're only 5, 7 tunes long because they are still just academic events, but they're not, you know, preset shows or something. But it's so good to be back, you know, in a packed room with people who are excited about
Definitely,
music,
yeah.
putting everything into it. Feels
Yeah.
great to be back at it.
Yep. It's crazy. Yeah. Yeah, so I guess thanks so much for being on this interview.
Oh, my great pleasure. Please, anytime, and stay in touch.
Do you have any future gigs or any future projects planned? Any
I'm writing a
reissue?
bunch of new music right now. I'm going to record it this summer. In a couple of months, I'm going to record the instrumental parts of it, and I might be singing a bit more on this record. So I might be doing some overdubbing of some vocals because I'm not the world's most dependable vocalist. So there's that, and I've got a bunch of stuff lined up. I'm finally doing my own show in Nelson because after 3 years living here and being sideman on about 8 dozen different little things here and there, with I've made friends with everybody in the region, and I have access to our school's theater. So in 3 weeks, I'm putting on a show on the 22nd here. I'm not coming to Manitoba anytime soon, but I
Oh,
need to
damn.
because I got a brother in Portage,
Yeah.
and his daughter. I got a niece who's just graduating from the program at Brandon, where she's a classical guitar player.
Yeah.
And a few years ago, I was out there and got to meet some of the people and play with them. And I've got to do it again. So when I do, I will be sure and let you know.
Cool. Yeah, are there any tracks from I guess Solomon's Dance, because that's the only one available right now. But are there any particular tracks that you like to play it with?
That's a good one. I'm quite partial to you mentioned Leonard Cohen. I think that's a nice one.
Yeah, that'd be a good one. Yeah.
Excellent.
Thanks to Mike Rudd for being here on the show. We'll end off with three tracks from his collab album with Peter Bernstein, Solomon's Dance, titled Shuffle Pants, Petroglyph, and Leonard Cohen. This is Canadiana Suite signing off.
Thank you.